think the topic of our discussion today is central to the future of Eastern Europe and to the developments that take place in this dramatic transition which is going on, as any that we are likely to consider in our discussions here in the Rosenstiel series. It is from communist legality to the rule of law, prospects and problems. And no one is better qualified to address this subject than Professor Lech Falandas. He is the 1990 Eisenhower Exchange Fellow. The Eisenhower Exchange Program accomplished what last spring the University of Virginia tried to accomplish. We were anxious to have him visit and participate in a seminar which Mrs. Rosenstiel sponsored at that time, but we're equally pleased that he should come now. He's professor of criminology and penal law, at chair of criminology, the faculty of law at Warsaw University. He was educated at the University of Warsaw, at the University of Geneva, at Carleton University in Ottawa, Canada, and at the Max Planck Institute in Freiburg, Federal Republic of Germany. He's the author of 7 major works in Polish, including Around the Radical Criminology, and another work, The Injured Person in Criminal Law and Victimology. He's published in addition some 150 scholarly publications, essays, journal articles, and other publications. He has had a public advisory role in recent months and years, including serving on the Senate's Rule of Law and Human Rights Commission, on the Social Legislation Council for Solidarity, on the Helsinki Committee on Poland, in Poland, and on the Ministry of Justice Commission for the Reform of Penal Law. The purpose of his Eisenhower Exchange Fellowship is to understand U.S. criminal justice systems in order to recommend reform in Poland, and to learn how social problems are addressed by local institutions and organizations. So he's traveled widely, not into outer space, but almost with the same intensity in normal space, from one part of the country to another, from different types of communities. And we look forward to his discussion of that trip and his observation, but especially to the fundamental subject from communist legality to the rule of law. Pleasure to have you.
Thank you very much, Professor Thompson, for the introduction. So I don't think there's no need to add anything to this introduction, which is too good, I think, to me. Anyway, I would like to thank to the people which contributed to the possibility to speak to you today. And this is Lady Blanca Rosenstiel, which I really am very grateful, and to Professor Thompson also, because in my very hard travel I have here in the United States, this is a very nice opportunity, and it reminds me really my genuine work, my genuine job. I like very much the university, so I'm trained to talk to the people, and this is my profession. Okay, and I enjoyed this last week of my stay here in the United States, to be in this very historic, very nice place, and to have the possibility to to share with you some of my thoughts, my own thoughts, which I'm going to present in a not scientific way, in that sense that I really hate myself, a jargon of lawyers they use in order not to be understood by the open public. So I really hate it, and I'm trying to translate the legal jargon into the normal language. So I'm glad that I can say at the University of Warsaw that I'm a man who knows two languages. Some of these lawyers, they know just only one. And they're making a good money with it, unknown language. Well, just one thing. Well, my background is really that I'm a professor of criminal law and criminology, basically. So you may ask me why, being a professor of criminology or criminal law, why are you trying to deal with very broad issues like philosophy of law or law in general or changing legality, rule of law, things like that? Well, I was asking myself, why does it so that I'm being a criminal lawyer by education, I'm dealing with politics and economy? And finally, I realized that the answer is very simple. These two areas are highly criminal, and were really highly criminal under communism. I mean, this was just my subject, my proper field. And it is probably to some extent everywhere. So now I feel justified that I can deal with some broader things. Well, the lecture will not be exactly about Poland, because I understand quite well that Poland is a place which interests us very much, Poles or some Polish Americans. But to the rest of the world, it's just a place at the map of the world. And I think we have to avoid probably to make people suffer with our Polish problems. So what I'm going to do is rather to present problems of the period of transition, which to outline a picture of this transition, which may be applied, I think, to any changes of that type. That means it concerns probably the Eastern Europe as a whole. It may concern also another countries like Nicaragua, perhaps, maybe Cuba in the future. And so this is going to be a rather general presentation. But of course, I would be not a real Pole if I didn't mention Poland, at least from time to time. And I would like to start with few observations, few remarks concerning the recent history of Poland. Exactly the Poland under the communist rule, which the way I see it, at least, what were the peculiarities of Poland? So Poland was a really unique country in this Eastern Hemisphere. And why this was so unique? Because of a couple of reasons. And first of all, it's not entirely known. Private ownership of land, private farmers, always existed in Poland. In no other communist country in the whole Eastern Europe, including Soviet Union, such a thing existed. There was no private farming, private ownership. This was one feature of Poland. The second one was the Catholic Church, which was never defeated by the communists. By the way, these both traditional forces of Polish society, private farmers, landowners, small landowners, and the Catholic Church, there were these traditional forces of Polish society which were never defeated by Stalin, even in the worst period of Stalinism, which was something like 1952-53. It didn't happen in any country. And that was the reason that in Poland, the open unrest against communism was constant. So the majority of a society never accepted the existing system, never, because there were some people from the National Army which were fighting, which were staying in forests, you know, fighting still up to in 1950 even, and in 56 there was a first big workers' protest, and then it was 68, then it was 70, then it was 76, then 80, 81, martial law in 89. So this was really much more than in all other Eastern countries taken together in the only poll. So the conclusion is that, at least in my view, this is the country which is leading really in these post-communist changes. So we are just ahead of the others, no matter what are the external features, like Romania. You say, well, the open revolution. Romania is just, they have many, many years ahead to go. I think we are the first, and that's why I think the experience of Poland is, or maybe useful to some other countries. And now, a little bit about, a little bit more scientific, let's say, about we are slowly approaching this notion of communist legality. What does it really mean? And I would like to start with the assumption which is relatively simple. Let me put it as follows, that if we look at the history of mankind, the history of societies, we can see two basic models, very general models or patterns of law and authority or law and power. It is probably not very much scientific, but this is the way I see it. Well, the one model, which is relatively young, is the model which is known as Western or democratic, which has its roots in ancient Greece and Rome, of course, in a European culture or Judeo-Christian values, also Renaissance and even Enlightenment. So this is deeply rooted in European culture. And the final shape of that model was given in the 18th century by European and American philosophers and politicians. This is the model which is based on such values as freedom, as liberty and human rights, putting it very briefly, in a very simple way, that there are human rights, natural human rights, and the power, the authority is coming from the people. People are forming the authority, and this is a sort of social contract, which is the society, basically. And of course, the law in such a system is created by the society, by the representatives of the society in some sort of democratic way. Well, this model is very well known here, so I don't have to go into details. And this is, by the way, the model which is also known in Poland, in Europe generally. But the opposite model, which is much more older, we are forgetting this. The much older model is a model which you can call Eastern or despotic or, in modern terminology, totalitarian. This is the model which is Eastern. And why I'm saying Eastern? Because this model is in Eastern culture or Asian culture is for many thousands of years it exists. And this model has some entirely different assumptions. The authority over the society comes from nowhere. I mean, you never choose your authority. You have it simply, and you have to submit. There is no such thing like natural or inborn human rights. No, no. What you are born with are rather duties. You have some duties to the power, to the master. And the values which are supported in such a model is constraint, discipline, subjection, obedience, things like that. And of course, in such a, well, all these rights people enjoy or may have come from the authority. They are given by the state. They may be taken off in any moment. And the lawmaking process takes part with no access of the society, because this is just the will of a master, of a king or first secretary, whatever you put in this place. So these are just two models. Of course, it's we must remember that no society in history was a pure realization of any model. Okay, there were always mixtures, and I think they still are the mixtures of two. And the evaluation of a given system is usually done by which model is prevalent, which model is more important to a given system. And the Polish legal system in 1944 was simply invaded by that type of Asian totalitarian model. We used to have a different one. Poland before the war, in these 20 years of independence between Hitler and Stalin, nice neighbors, of course, and the just 20 years of that independence, we used to have a purely democratic model of Western. And we were invaded by this Eastern totalitarian model of law, and of course, the result was so-called communist legality. And 10 years ago, by the way, I formulated what I call 10 commandments of so-called communist legality. Fortunately, it's now a history, because I didn't mention that, but the Polish People's Republic, as a name, as official name of the state, ceased to exist at the very last day of December 1989. So it's the history, Polish People's Republic, fortunately, the history. Now it's a Republic of Poland. Of course, with many remnants of the old system, but it doesn't exist anymore. And these 10 commandments, I should know it without reading, yes. But I'm not a good probably priest, so I have to read it, you know, these 10 commandments. I'm sorry. It will be more, maybe more clear that way. So first is, law is subordinated to political aims and interests of the ruling group or ruling party, if you want. Politics prevail over law, which does not limit it anyhow. So this is law. The politics is before the law. Law is a political instrument of the ruling party, which makes it possible for the party to elevate to the rank of statute anything it wishes, thus making it obligatory for the whole of society. The will of the party may become a law for the whole of society. Social groups from without the ruling party and society as a whole exert no actual influence on the contents of law and the lawmaking process. Then the fourth is the human rights and civil liberties are protected only to the extent to which they do not clash with the interests of the group in power. Or the, you can read this group in power as a communist party. Political authorities are not bound by the law and are the only group to change or infringe that law. You know, political authorities means communist party all the time. Law preserves its democratic externals, which never function in practice. By the way, many people from the West are misled by this. Law is created by a legislative agency, which is permanently dominated by one party, and by other state agencies, fully subordinated to the party. There is no independent agency to review the consistence of law with the Constitution and international conventions. In the field of protection of human rights and civil liberties, both the Constitution and the international pacts are treated as collections of declarations with no actual use in social practice. The official propaganda depicts law as an expression of the will of the majority of citizens and the or society as a whole. And then finally, the 10th Amendment, which is 10th Commandment, which is theory of law and legal studies, are to justify the need for the actual existing legal system. The lawyers should cooperate with the authorities and defend their interests. This is a very simple way. By the way, many people objected at the university to that sort of picture of this communist legality. So now you knew it more or less how it looks, but this is this has a form of Ten Commandments, which is really good to publish and to distribute if there's no need anymore to do it. But of course, I published this 10 years ago, and it was working in the country. With what effect, I cannot tell you. What are the principles of the rule of law? What is the new principle we are looking for? It can also be put in a very simple way. Just four things, probably. Just four things we need. Just subordination of politics to law. The rule of law basically means that the law is ruling, not the politicians. And second is the participation of different social groups and forces in the making and application of that law. This is what is the second. The third is that the protection of human rights and civil liberties must be guaranteed to the broadest possible extent. And finally, there must be an independent review of the consistent of internal law to the international acts and treaties and pacts. No mention of the Constitution. Of course, there is no one model which will be here to follow, because the American model is different from the British one. The British one is different from the French one. The French one is different from the German one, and so on. So, well, but this is democracy. This is pluralism. Anybody can choose the model he wants to follow. We are now in that fortunate situation that we are trying to choose our model, to choose what's the best to follow in the West. And that's, by the way, the reason of my visit here in the States. I'm trying to learn myself what's the best here. Well, this was just the... just a few things. I don't want to take too much of your time to make you bored, but I would like to hear questions, and I will answer any question with pleasure, really. So this will be the second part of the lecture. Well, now the basic legal reforms of the period of transition, which I would like just to outline. And I'm unable to go into details because it would take so much time. In fact, being 2 months out of the country, I'm not up to date simply. So maybe it's much more than I can say you in this period. If you are 2 months out of the country, I'm not saying that you may become a minister or you may be imprisoned when you're back, but this is, the changes are quite fast, you know, quite fast. It's not enough to call my wife even once a week. But what I have learned recently is that one of my colleagues from the University of Warsaw, he used to be, he's a sociologist and a lawyer, and he was a specialist on prisons in Poland. He was very heavily criticizing the prison system. For many, many years he was doing this. Now he is appointed the chief of national corrections in Poland. That's a tragedy, I think, simply because now I'm looking, who will change whom? I mean, he will change the system, or the system will change him. And this is interesting for me, you know, if I'm looking for him, you know, if I know myself in charge, but this is just a tragedy, I think. And you can refuse. If they are asking you to take this, I mean, you must do it. You were criticized, so now you do, you show how to rule it. I mean, it's just incredibly difficult sometimes. About the changes, so what I would like to say is just to point the few directions which are the main direction of the legal reforms, because the whole legal system is, or legal and political system is transformed now. And of course, first of all, what we are doing now is the draft of a new constitution. Poland has a good tradition of constitutions, and we are drafting the new one, the post-communist democratic constitution. Well, it's a whole story behind it, of course. There were also some reforms which were in the area of constitutional law, in the area of political system, already done. We have such things like administrative court, which is a special court for administrative decisions. Then we have a constitutional court, which is in a sense similar to your Supreme Court. We have also a tribunal of the state, which is the court for the highest officials. And we also have a Senate, a president, and all these reforms from the last year, really. And our Senate, you can imagine the United States Senate as a one-year-old baby. So just, you know, this is our Senate, which is just one-year-old baby. I'm a sort of advisor to that baby. I'm a babysitter, in a sense. I mean, it's very interesting work, but the results are everywhere. Nobody knows. It's very interesting that even such a young kid like our Senate is already in conflict with House of Representatives, in a big conflict. Now, these people, they hate each other already, so this is perhaps the American tradition also a little bit. So the Constitution, this is the toughest job, I think. We are trying to ask some people from the States to advise us, to assist to these works, but the result, this is the main, let's say, the main direction, the new Constitution. And then what is also important, so we were slowly establishing the basic rights, like your Bill of Rights is, which are not so many, and it's, for example, we have abolished censorship in Poland. So now there's a freedom of speech, entire freedom of speech, under the supervision of criminal court only, and the free press. So it's just a complete freedom of press, freedom of information, freedom of speech. What is the next direction is we have already established an independent judiciary. Judiciary is no more a tool of Communist Party. By the way, the Communist Party does not exist anymore in Poland. It dismissed itself just a couple of months ago. So probably in the future, the only Communist Party will exist in the United States with something like 100 members or something, because you've got everything in this country, so you must perhaps have this type of the dinosaur or whatever, but it does not exist in Poland. But the communists were very smart, and they now call themselves social democrats. And they are, you know, friends of Willy Brandt immediately from one day to another. So, but our people, they know it. I mean, they know who, no matter how they call themselves, they know who they are. So independent judiciary, which is, I think, the one of the most successful reforms we have already established. With just an independent judiciary, not like here, because here is a different tradition. Not a tradition of common law, but at least in the sense of European continental democracy, we can say that there is an independent judiciary in Poland. The next direction of the reform is the restricting of the power of the police. In other words, and this is one of my topics here, to abolish or to dismiss the Ministry of Internal Affairs, the old type KGB, Soviet type, of the organization, which was really a state within a state, having the police force, the security police or political police, intelligence, counterintelligence, military troops, special military troops for the Ministry of Interior. By the way, the Russians are using the special military troops in all these republics. So this is a real state within a state. How to do it peacefully, nobody knows. Because these people, they have weapons and they are powerful. We have nothing except the social support. But if the economy goes down, 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 this support may be lost in some future. So this is one of the most important reforms, the reform of the police, which is probably as much important as the economy. Maybe it's even precondition to the economic reforms. And the reform of the whole criminal justice system with a substantive criminal law procedure, prison system, and so on. Then, finally, the freedom of assembly and freedom of association. This is already established. And what is going on is the law of property, which must be changed. Property must be back in the hands of owners. Well, the big robbery, which is called the nationalization or whatever you call it, the biggest robbery in the history of mankind, well, the deprivation of millions of people of their private property must be undone. That's what we are doing now. Well, I'm appearing on the TV program, which is saying, just give back to the people all these small shops, little factories, mills, pharmacies, things like that, small business, because the middle class was simply exterminated under communism. There's no middle class, but the middle class is the condition of democracy. But we are called middle class people of intelligentsia, let's say, in Poland, but we are really poor. We are no middle class. We are just poor, a little bit educated people, but just poor. I mean, we are not middle class. So, a law of property and economic freedoms, that's what is going on also. These are the basic directions. Of course, virtually all branches of law should be changed because Poland has placed the demand to join the Council of Europe. The Council of Europe, which was basically the organization for Western Europe, and the condition is that our legal system must conform to the European Convention of Human Rights. And these standards are really very high. I think these standards will be kept by our legal system in the near future. Let me just finish by some more sentimental accent, because being in such a nice place and coming back to Poland, in a sense, at least with my thoughts, well, I would like to say that Poland is coming back to the Western world, or, if you want, is coming back to the free world. But I would like to remind you, I think, or just to make the point that I remember twice, at least, Poland has saved this free world from the alien forces, I think. The first time it was, which is very much known in Europe, I mean, which should be known in Europe, the first was the Battle of Vienna in 1683, when the Western Europe was saved from Turkish invasion. Well, the Pope was asking our King John III, just save us, and he did. For his wife, by the way, she was a very Catholic. So he did it at that time. It was probably a mistake for Poland. But, you know, this was one of these battles which historians called it the world. The world depended upon the result. And the second time, which almost nobody knows, was 1920. The Bolsheviks, the Soviets, were just on the other side of the Vistula River in Warsaw. They were approaching Warsaw. There was something here like 25 kilometers from the center. And it was 1920. There was already a revolution, communist revolution in Berlin. And there was a famous Battle of Warsaw, finally won by Marshal Piłsudski. And he was back in Kyiv somewhere in Ukraine. If this battle was lost, what would be the history of the world? If the Russians win in 1920 over Poland, really hard to say. So I'm not saying this to pretend that there is a debt which the West owe to Poland. No, not at all. But what I'm saying is that this country is, I think, is still surviving its 1,000-year history with not always very friendly neighbors like Russia and Germany on both sides. It's an interesting but really tough history. This year and the next year, we will have some anniversaries to celebrate. This year, on August 15, will be the 70th anniversary of this Battle of Warsaw for the first time in a free country. So this battle was won twice. And the next year, we will have two anniversaries of the bicentennial of our first constitution of 1791, which was the second written constitution in the world, and the 70th anniversary of our March constitution of 1921. So there are coming, of course, some celebrations, but we like to celebrate, but we would prefer that our country really will recover in the near future. I think it's quite possible with a little help of God and the people of goodwill from all over the world. Thank you very much for your attention.
Who would like to ask the first question? Professor Fierenbach.
Well, I admire your courage and your excellent presentation. I want to ask if you might consider including in your basic model of democratic type two fundamental points which I didn't hear, namely the fundamental assumption, first of all, of the dignity and sanctity of each individual, which I think underpins basically the democratic regime. And secondly, the concept of limited power, which ties in with that, and which is institutionalized by a whole host of mechanisms involving division of power, checks and balances, judicial review, etc. Would you comment on that?
Yeah, I fully agree with that. I think the first, the dignity of the individual is, I think, well, I was very brief, really. It is included in my model in the notion of inborn or natural human rights, which is, well, behind that, no matter what the concept is, the sanctity or sovereignty of an individual. I fully agree with that, but, well, of course, I also should say that the limits of power, of course, I think it may be driven a contrario from this second model, when power is unlimited. I was too brief. I could read it. It is a little bit more precise in a written version, but I was just avoiding, and especially that this democratic model you know quite well, so that you know better than I do. So thank you for that comment.
Next question.
You can ask any question which concern contemporary Poland, Europe, or whatever. Don't just feel restricted to.
Bill Wemple.
Could you comment a little more on how the concept of the representative government, the elected government, will be embalmed in law, so to speak, as it is with us and the British and some others. In Poland, the history of an absolutist model that you described back in its own past. Do you think that that can be successfully obliterated? And for things like universal military service, would that be necessary? Maybe it will. Maybe it is now. I don't know.
Could you repeat a part of the question for them, or do you want me?
Yes, the question.
They can hear the question.
Okay. The question is about how we can realize, let's say, the idea of elected government, viewing this tradition of 45 years of this despotic or totalitarian system. An example is, for example, the draft of the military service, which is as a duty. How could we manage this? Well, I would like to answer it that way, that I was talking just only about the last 45 years of so-called communism in Poland, which is, by the way, a deviation from Polish tradition and Polish history. We never had in our history any type of absolute power or absolutist type of power except this communism. This last 45 years, which we prefer call totalitarian rather than despotic or absolutist. But, well, till 18th century, Poland was, on one hand, a European superpower, but it was the only democratic country at that time in the whole world. This was, of course, the democracy for the nobles, for the noblemen. But these noblemen were something like 30-40% of the nation. And this was, by the way, the reason we lost our independence, because our neighbors, namely Prussia and Russia, they developed a very strong central states, and they defeated us finally. But in the 17th century, Poland was from Baltic Sea to Black Sea. This was just a huge superpower with a sort of anarchy, no central power. King was just very rich, much appreciated, but he's got no power at all. The noblemen were everywhere. They were the masters. So I think our tradition is really what our people understand, what our people feel, what our people understand as a value is democracy. Even if Poland is probably the worst place in the world to install a real democracy. If you are between Russia and Germany, I mean, you can just dream about this. Well, but the dreams are sometimes stronger than reality, you know. And that's the reason why Poles, they know it simply. A little kids, they know. Because they have learned it from their parents, and their parents from their grandparents, and that's the way it is. So I'm not really afraid. What I'm afraid is whether it's a proper place to install, you know, a good democratic state. I really don't know. But I like this place, and I hope that it will come sooner or later. The military draft is... This is now very doubtful whether we should have the draft and the army by draft, or should we have some sort of professional army or volunteers or whatever. It's under discussion. By the way, the Polish army is declining in numbers. They have no weapons, almost no ammunition, nothing. I mean, it doesn't exist. Even no horses like in 1920. So this is just the army. The Soviets made it, you know, weak. Especially, but you remember, Stalin just didn't hesitate to kill 15,000 of Polish officers in 1941. It's still remember. But with the army, well, it's also the discussion, to have the army or not to have. I can tell you, the young people at the university, which I know, they are mostly pacifists. And they hate this military service, which used to be the communist Warsaw Pact type. But in the future, it may change. That's the answer. Sure, it's not very disciplined, but just the idea.
What about the Polish peasant? I'm on a national fellowship program, and there were two projects this year of young scholars revisiting the great work on the Polish peasant, sturdy, rational, independent. Is that an element in this new development or not?
Yeah, I started from the remark that Polish peasants with the Catholic Church, they were never defeated, even by Stalin. It means something. But the tragedy now is that, first the communists, they made the agricultural reform, which is not the communist invention. It happens in the West. I mean, they were just some farms were given to the peasants. And then Stalin, he tried to collectivize all this, and he didn't succeed. Nobody wanted to make this sort of Soviet-type collectivization. And, the tragedy now is that these farms are small. These farms are old-fashioned. These farms are non-efficient. And the more and more young people, they go to the cities. And this is a real tragedy. I mean, these people, they own their land, but there's no good farming in the sense of modern farming. The individual peasant recently, he cannot afford to buy a tractor because it's too expensive, but probably he doesn't need any tractor for a small farm. That's the problem, how to modernize our agriculture. I think that these people, being myself a second generation from peasant family, I think these people are still good and still full of energy and goodwill, and they can really work. But the changes must come. I don't know how to do it. I mean, there are other specialists. Sometimes you must simply rely. I don't see any, for a moment, I don't see any positive changes in our agriculture, unfortunately. But hopefully we will have some.
Next question. Yes. Louise.
What role do you think that the Polish nobles will play in the new government, and will they keep their titles?
You mean the nobles?
The Polish nobles, yes. We have a lot of Polish counts so-and-so around here.
Interesting. They should be in the new Senate. I mean, because this Senate now is it's a strange Senate, because this baby I was talking about, it's just that the people which are in Senate are mostly university professors and some workers. So it's Senate, well, no nobles, maybe a couple of these people. But by the way, our Senate is 99% solidarity with and one guy who is non-solidarity. Well, he's a very successful businessman from Pure Voivodeship or something, and he bought votes simply. He bought the voters. I don't know how he was able to do it. But for a moment, there's no aristocracy, no nobleman in Senate. But I think, as far as I know, when I was out of the country, there was a first meeting of Polish noblemen, and they're trying to appear. I mean, it's a very educated, very historical class of the society. That's true. But what will be the role in the future? I think it will be considerable. It, of course, depends upon what census you apply to be a senator. Okay, if it's I think it the role of that class is mostly in the culture and the education, all the things. Maybe no more in politics, but who knows? Maybe we'll restore a monarchy one day with Wałęsa as a king. Jesus Christ, it would be maybe everything is possible, you know. This is the answer. So for a moment, it's not an important thing.
There's
but
no thought of taking away the titles the way our government.
No. I mean, there's no such right to take away the title. I mean, it's you still have your title, except that you couldn't. You know, for many years it was nothing. I mean, attached to the title. But it all may still be alive. If it has a meaning, it will be shown one day, I think. I'm really not an expert at that time, as I told you, as a second generation son of a farmer, of a peasant. So it's not a good question. I'm not an expert.
Can I remind everybody, this may be the last time we have a chance for a while to... because there is a real threat and danger of people going back and forth. Yesterday when I was in Washington, a group in a senator's office made the point, well, this has become political because this is this statement about Georgetown, the chief of police, the head of police in the city as a whole, had said was a political attack on the present regime, particularly the unfortunate mayor, and that in fact everybody felt quite free to walk back and forth in Georgetown. But what is the problem of crime in Warsaw or Krakow, or how serious is it? What are the sources of it? How much more effective will solidarity be in bringing it under control? This kind of question.
Now, well, it will need a separate lecture on this on this topic, or the whole series of lectures. But I would like to I would try to be as brief as possible. I think this problem of criminality and criminal justice is a sort of a dilemma which nobody can solve, in fact, neither here or in Poland, no matter what is the system. It's a very, very complex, very difficult issue. Particularly, it is the issue very easy to play in politics. So, if you invest in the people's fear of crime, or if you're showing, well, the media are showing, you know, the terrible cases of murder or whatever, people get scared and they get frustrated and they want to have severe punishment or to have all these people locked up in prisons and so on. Well, that's the normal thing. Our experience is that severity of punishment does not contribute to any extent, I mean, has no links at all with the criminality. No links at all. For many years, our criminality was relatively small. I can tell you the example. In the whole Poland, the nation of 38 million, the number of homicides, killings, is 600 a year, just 600, which is less than in some American cities. This level of criminality was really relatively low, at least the violent criminality. But the criminal law system, criminal justice, was extremely harsh with the people, because this was the communist obsession, that they will eliminate crime. They will show through the West that there is no crime in our country. They will show through the West that the capitalism is a source of crime, okay? And finally, our prisons were terribly overcrowded with no apparent reason. And people just sympathize simply with so-called criminals. But on the other hand, the communist propaganda was quite efficient, was quite effective in making people more severe in that sense, that the people wanted, you know, the people are accustomed, the public opinion is accustomed to be very harsh, very tough on crime. And this was, in my view, this is 100% the influence of the media, 100%. And the only time I remember when these media, which were pushing or accelerating this anti-crime attitude, was completely inefficient. This is a very unique experience. This was the first solidarity period of 1980-1981. People were so happy with this, you know, this fight of the system with the victory. But the police, the media were saying, well, there's a crime around, anarchy, no order, crime around, people are killed. So nobody believed it. I mean, nobody cared even. Well, this is just a baloney, I think. And this was the only period I remember. People didn't care about crime. But shortly after, the martial law was introduced, and again the media started to be very tough on crime, and people started to believe. And they believe in that even now. But in Warsaw, the situation is, it's very, very interesting situation now, because our prison population is now cut by half. The half of prisoners were simply released. Not political prisoners, just the ordinary criminals. They were released for some reasons, like, you know, the overcrowding of prison, critique, and the demand of personnel. People which are working in prison, they are saying, we cannot handle so many people. It's dangerous. I mean, it's, you can't work with them. But the on the streets of Warsaw, you don't have any police anymore. It's just a city without the police. Because the police is claiming that there are 3,000 of vacancies in the police force in Warsaw, that they have only 30 cars, which are this emergency unit. It's just 30 cars for a city approaching 2 million. And of course, if the chief of the police is saying, because public opinion on one hand hates the police, I mean hates very much the police, but on the other hand wants to be protected, so people are complaining, where's the police? But the chief of the police is saying, listen people, I can do nothing. I mean, I have no cars, no people, no equipment, nothing. So this is just an invitation to young boys to burglarize the shops, especially when the bottle of vodka costs 25,000 and there is an economic crisis. So, and the one thing they can be sure, 100%, that they will never be catched. I mean, the police hardly can register the number of burglaries. But I'm amazed by the decency of our people. They don't murder themselves, they don't rape themselves, they don't beat, but the number of violent crime is more or less the same. So this violent crime does not seem to depend from the police presence, but the police is just to protect the property, perhaps, just a simple presence of the police. And this is how the Marxian old assumption is now evaluated as true, but the police is to protect the owners, the ownership, the halves, okay? But this is, by the way, true even under socialism or the post-socialist period. So this is a very strange situation. There's no police. It may be a game, a political game from the Ministry of Interior. The people are saying, okay, just stop and show the people, listen, you wanted to be free. What you have got is the anarchy, chaos, and without, you will need us one. Sooner, you will need us. Just look, you'll be murdered, you'll be threatened, and this is the sort of the game. They probably can do much more, but they don't do it. But they are still the same Ministry of Interior. Once the police is separated from this ministry and became, let's say, the police serving the society, will be completely different. The real mess, really. And I'm afraid that our reforms of criminal law, in order to have it more liberal, more decent, let's say, less harsh, now are very doubtful because of the public opinion, which may be against of that type of reform, which may say one day be tough on crime. And the politicians, they really like to play that card, I think. Well, that's a very brief illustration.
Questions on this subject, or Victor Yumpy?
Sir, are you working through a possibility of a kind of a Roman or Napoleon code system, or any tendency to go to Anglo-American law, the way of corpus and carva juri, statute law and common law?
It's a very good question, because well, our tradition is basically what you call here a civil law tradition, which is a French Napoleon Code in the area of civil law. This is the Polish tradition, and criminal law is more German-oriented, perhaps. The model comes from German. But I think we have never had such a system like, which is called common law, which is seen as a different approach. It is also, in the science at least, in jurisprudence, it is a common opinion is that these systems are very different. I doubt it very much whether they are so much different, because the final result, the outcome of any rational legal provision is more or less the same, because the same is the common sense. Almost in every place, if the law is a sort of common sense, so it does not differ, because it depends finally about the nature of man. But this is the same. So I think I experienced this many times, that the common law solutions and the continental law, the statute law, are not so different. And I'm really open. What I'm saying is not to be restricted in our law reforms. Be open to the American, be open to the British solution. But the answer I'm getting all the time is, this is a different system. This is what you cannot use. This is, you cannot apply in the continental Europe because it will not work, because it's a different issue. And this is the answer I'm getting. So the majority of our lawyers is still cultivating, let's say, civil law tradition, or Napoleon, that type of 19th century law, both criminal and civil law. But there are some people, where we are minority, saying that this country is really like after the war. I mean, you can do anything. Anything after that period. And maybe, why not the American model? Why not? Because if you can do anything, so just more courage. But I think the traditionalists, they prevail. They're saying, okay, let's follow French system, let's follow German criminal law examples or things like that. But at least in the area of constitutional law and constitutional solutions, I think we will follow some American examples. That is for sure, because it was already a sort of our tradition of the period of before the war. This constitution of 1921 and 1935 were more or less based on, were similar to the American. So I cannot really tell you what will be the choice, but I'm telling only that the traditional point of view that these systems are completely different still prevails.
If you had more ethnic conflict in Poland, would you need more police and more modifications of the criminal law system for that reason?
Fortunately, we don't have any ethnic problems, I think. We are a very homogeneous nation now. Before the war, it was not the case, because the eastern territories, which were White Russia, Lithuania, and Ukraine, there were some minorities and some problems there. But we don't have these territories now. It's no Russian, Soviet Union. So we are a very homogeneous country, and this is the reason, of course, that the criminality is much more lower, generally speaking. Well, the second reason is that we don't have, I mean, our public doesn't have any firearms. It's not, I mean, it used to be that the police and the military and the security police and secret service, they had weapons, firearms, but nobody had it except for hunting. But now people, they probably will ask for some weapons, for some firearms, at least under the concession system, okay, which you have to have a permission for that, not like here. But it may contribute to the increase of criminality. More firearms. People already have for self-defense a sort of a toy which is a, it looks like a regular revolver or pistol, like a regular Colt 38 or 45, because this is exactly like the genuine model, except that this is for tear gas. I mean, it's used, just to incapacitate Nobody knows how it works, by the way, but nobody shoots for a moment. So this is, all these problems can, like the easier access to the firearms and generally more freedom. The more freedom you have, it's equally more freedom to good and more freedom to evil. So this is just a natural consequence of freedom, because the only safe life you can have is a life in prison. If you are well guarded, well fed, I mean, it's like a hotel, you know, Sheraton or whatever, but you are very safe. But you are not free. I mean, comfort, freedom, these things don't go together very often. So if you are free, you are not very safe. And that's the problem which we are facing. And we still don't have a drug problem, for example, because we are a poor country, so nobody exports drug to Poland, because nobody is going to buy it. I mean, you are too poor. Here the money is, so you've got drugs. But there's no business to deal with Poland selling drugs. But our drug number one is still alcohol, which we are traditionalists. And every third man in Poland is an alcoholic, including myself, of course. By the way, I don't drink since 6 years, so it's a big problem. I'm joking, but it's a real big problem. The theory of Michel de Montaigne that the more you go to the north of Europe, the more you have to drink and strong alcohol. And it's, by the way, true. I mean, the Russians, the Poles, Finnish people, for example, Finns, Swedish, Irish. I don't know, there must be something in this, but this is, why this is so, I can explain it. The way I understand it, if you are in Africa or in the Mediterranean area, you just drink wine, or you're just in Africa, you cannot even eat, I mean, you lie, you take the sun, and that's all, you don't move too much because it's hot. But if you live, you know, with the snow and the 30 degrees below zero, yeah, in order to start moving, you must drink something strong. I mean, and then you must move all the time. I mean, you must, because otherwise you cannot lie, because you're just frozen and dead. I mean, that's the reason. But basically, it's true. It's God's will. I mean, it's not my interpretation. And of course, we can cope with that. But for a moment, the people, they drink heavily, because still they don't see. They don't have hope. I mean, that hope is not very clear, you know. They probably know that there will be better, because if you reach the bottom, well, under the bottom there is nothing. I mean, it must be better one day, sooner or later, but it's not enough. So that's, they must have some sort of more clear hope, and they probably will stop drinking, because to stop drinking is not so difficult. You do it just for somebody, for your family, for your kids, for himself sometimes. It's just not a problem. The problem is that majority of people, they don't have any reasons why to stop. Why to stop? Like drugs. So that's the, let's say, more happy example that I am, but the rest, well, a lot of people are suffering, and the country is losing. Yes?
And do you think there's any possibility that women will have equal rights in Poland?
They already have, I think. They already have. Well, somebody's telling in Polish that they have too much, perhaps, the right in Poland. It's a good comment. It's a good comment. I think, well, even... Well, they're working hard, really, Polish women. There's no model like here that the woman or wife doesn't work. She usually works. And what the problem is, however, that if you look more scientifically at the phenomenon, you realize that this discrimination still exists. I cannot tell you to what extent, but for example, let me give you as an example the court system, the lowest court, the magistrate court. 90% the women are working in the lowest instance, you know, the most hard-working court are 90% women, because they used to be not well paid and so on. But the second court you've got, the voivodeship court, the district court, you can hear maybe all the district court, let's say, oh, there's just a few women, maybe 20% or something. But in the Supreme Court, which is something like 100 persons, there's just two or three. So it is an example that by some reasons, the system was giving more chance to men than women. Well, there also are some comments which I will not translate. But anyway, I think it will become an issue in Poland, even if the Polish tradition is a sort of cavalry or tradition giving the respect to women. I mean, this sort of not machismo, but rather, you know, this is a woman as a value or something. But it's of course now much more complicated. There are some feminists in Poland already, the feminist organization. By the way, I saw on TV a very interesting program, which on one hand, there was a program about alimony, about paying for children from divorced families and so on. And there were, on one hand, there were feminists, girls from feminist organization. They were very, they were very radical, but what was the picture I remember as a funny picture was all these fathers, you know, deprived of the power over children or restricted in the rights, and they form something like union of victimized fathers or abused fathers, really, because the majority of magistrate courts, as I told you, are women. So if the guy is coming to the court, forget it. I mean, he's just lost. And they formed the union of victimized or abused fathers. It's very nice. I started to laugh at this, but I said, well, this is serious, because these people look really serious. And finally, I felt a lot of sympathy to them. They were really poor. They were the men which were obviously discriminated. So this is the answer.
One last question. Will you have any sense of what young people at the university are thinking about for the future? What careers do they see as real opportunities for them? Are they going to law? Are they going to business?
It's a good question. I must tell that first, the source of my optimism for Poland is that I'm working at the university. Every year I see a group of really brilliant, talented, intelligent young people every year. So I must stay optimistic. And I'm sending them my graduate students. Well, I'm sending them mostly to the government institution or to Senate House as lawyers. I'm saying, okay, just start there. It's a very interesting time. You will see it, because this is the very beginning. They can be divided, I think, into two categories. One is the people which are really, which want to stay in Poland and to fight for the future. So be engaged in any sort of activity in Poland, including business, including international business, everything. They are trying to learn languages, so they are trying to be good. But there is still a group of young people which thinks about immigration still. Now, not political immigration, but a sort of economic immigration, which is, it's a human right. They can try. But I'm amazed by their goodness and their basic, how to say, ability to sacrifice. They know it's really hard time, but they want to stay and they want to fight. So that's the reason I'm optimistic. Maybe it's I have a distorted view because I'm too optimistic, because I'm working in a very privileged place. University is not a work. My wife is always saying it's not a job. I mean, just what you're doing is just drinking coffee, looking at young girls and talking to the people. I mean, it's just bring some money to home from time to time. Well, I said, okay, I mean, well, I enjoy it, by the way, but it's tough sometimes. What I'm trying to do, because I must have some other serious job. By the way, I'm trying to write a column, you know, in the press to appear on TV, so it's something. But I think that our young generation is, I find it's really, really almost perfect. I cannot tell they could be better. But I may be wrong. The future will show us if I'm wrong or correct.
It's a good note, I think, on which to end. The other thing that Professor Philandes said just before we came in is that his optimism also was based on the future of his three children, who were unable to accompany him.
There must be an optimist.
If he survived. But these things make our inspirations to all of us, and the fact that Poland has taken the lead in all this momentous, turbulent change that is going on in Eastern Europe, it seems to me, justifies more than maybe we knew when Lady Blanca urged us to have such discussions, justifies the focus throwing the spotlight on Poland at this stage. And we hope very much that now that you've been here once, even though you couldn't come last April, you'll come next April, and we see you again before too long. Thank you.
Thank you.